Hello, Jason, and welcome to the Liftoff Annual Special for 2020.
Who are you and what are you doing here?
I'm Stephen Hack, and I'm commander of this mission.
And I'm Jason Snell, and I'm the pilot of this mission, which sounds better than it is. Because the pilot on the space shuttle doesn't fly.
No, you just get a cool title.
Yeah.
So what are we doing today?
Liftoff is a podcast about space and related subjects. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to hear the latest about those things.
That's
from
true.
Us. Today, however, because this is for all of our members out there, and we love you. Thank you for supporting us and Relay FM in general. We're going to draft something. And what we're going to draft, we decided this time, is space shuttle missions.
Woo!
That's right. So we're going to have, what, five rounds, did we say? Four or five rounds, something like that, of space shuttle missions. Now, there were many space shuttle missions.
Mm-hmm.
From 1977 to 2011, there were 135 space missions, as well as five flight test missions. So there's many to choose from, and we're only going to choose, eight or ten of them. So the best. We're basically curating a list of the best space shuttle missions.
We have to decide who goes first, because that's very important in drafts. And mm-hmm. I have a coin we can flip. This is a challenge coin issued after the first flight. So on one side of it is the mission patch with Columbia lifting off, and the other side is Columbia landing. It's a little landing gear out. So I can flip it if you want to pick a side.
Sure. I'm going to pick the mission patch, heads.
All right. It is heads.
Oh, boy.
Get to go first.
I get to go first?
Mm-hmm.
No way. Well, then I pick STS-1.
Ah! I knew it was going to go high. I knew it was going to go high.
It's right there. We've talked about it on Liftoff before. The first... Okay. It's a test flight of a vehicle that has never flown before. Because the space shuttle was designed to not be able to be flown in an uncrewed configuration.
Right.
So like the Soviet space shuttle, the Buran, that flew a couple of times, but it never had a crew on board. The space shuttle, no such luck. So they got John Young and Bob Crippen, test pilots. John Young, one of the great American astronauts of all time, to climb in this thing and take it for a ride and see what happened, which is like super scary. It was tense. A couple of years ago, I read a book about this mission. Have you read that book?
Yeah, it's really good.
Anyway, like they weren't sure. They wanted to check on the thermal tiles. They didn't know what they were doing. They hoped it would all work, and it did. But it's such a huge moment, and also fraught with such risk. They were only in orbit for a couple of days, but they did 36 orbits, and it was just those two guys in the whole space shuttle. It was really just there as this test mission. That was the whole plan of it. And as a kid, I remember this was such a big deal. Essentially the first memory of a space launch that I have in my life is of STS-1, which went up in April of 1981. So I would have been, perfect age for that 10-year-old kid, very excited about seeing the space shuttle launch. And of course, these early space shuttle missions, Stephen, have, they painted the external tank. So it's the white space shuttle. It's the pristine white space shuttle, like it's a model that somebody built. Whereas later, we get that orangey foam. They painted the foam the first couple of years because it looked better that way. So, STS-1, what can I say? It's what a groundbreaking mission. Just huge respect for Young and Crippen. I got to see Crippen at a NASA social event, and I was just kind of in awe of him and those guys. And all the way to the long landing at Edwards Air Force Base in California at the end of it out in the desert. That's just a great mission, start to finish.
The Air Force ended up shooting photos of the orbiter because one of these test items was how does the thermal coating, how do all these tiles hold up? And it had some damage. Columbia had some damage, but they shot it with this reconnaissance satellite.
They'd never done the the thermal tile thing. Mm-hmm. Not only was it the, you know, it was a crewed spaceship that a spaceship that came glided to a landing, with landing gear and stuff, but the thermal tile system had never really been tested. All the other, you know, NASA missions were ablative heat shield, and this was this these lightweight, you know, heat shedding thermal tiles, and there was great fears of whether it had been broken and what they would do and all of that, but it all carried off.
Yeah, that's a good first pick. It was gonna go probably for my first or second,
I figured.
Yeah, it's how does it not? So I'm gonna go with one just a couple of years after this. I'm gonna go with STS-7.
Oh, that was on my list.
Mm-hmm. This is Sally Ride's first flight, the first American woman astronaut in orbit. Huge deal. Way after Russia did it. Russia did it well before America. Mm-hmm. It was also the largest crew to fly. So you mentioned that Young and Crippen, they were just like two dudes in a whole space shuttle. And slowly over time, NASA built up the number of crew on a mission. So STS-7 was the first time with five people. That was a record at the time, the largest crew to ever fly in a single spacecraft, because all the other little capsules that were running around, you know, one, two, three people. So this was a big deal. Five souls on this spacecraft. Sally Ride ended up flying two missions. She also is the only person to have served on the commission studying both the Challenger and Columbia disasters. Mm-hmm. So I kind of pick STS-7 really to highlight Sally Ride. She was a real instrumental figure in the early, not only the early shuttle program, but for years to come with NASA. And not a super inspiring story.
Yep. She was also a professor at UCSD.
Mm-hmm.
So as a alumnus of that university, happy to point that out. Just gonna proudly point that out, that she was a physics professor at mm-hmm. UCSD at the end of her life. Good mission, good choice.
Yeah.
I think I like I said, I had it on my list of ones to pick. Mm-hmm. So that's the whole name of the game, right? Is that both of our first two picks we're on the other person's list. I think that's how it's supposed to work, right?
It came out after her death that she had been in a long-term relationship as the first gay astronaut, which is mm-hmm. also, I mean, think about 1983, not something that we would have been talking about. But she is a really inspiring figure in NASA history.
Yep. And my friend Randy, who is a journalist in San Diego, who I went to college with, he did a story a while ago about the statues in San Diego, and which ones might need to be pulled down because they're embarrassing. And also one of the things he pointed out was that there are almost no women represented in statues in San Diego. And his modest proposal, which I think is brilliant, is that there should be a Sally Ride statue.
Ooh, yeah.
And I think he heard from her partner, and it sounds like that might actually happen, which is pretty great. So maybe,
that'd be really cool.
Maybe at UCSD, maybe somewhere else. But yeah, Sally Ride for sure. All right, I'm very lucky because I'm going to get my top two picks I went to a shuttle launch, and I got to pick it, and that's why I'm picking STS-135, which means I've got the first and last.
And last. I figured you were going to do this. I figured this may have been your first pick, but there you go.
Well, until I won the coin flip, honestly. Yeah. I assumed you'd pick STS-1, actually, so I was going to get one of my two, but then I figured I just got to grab STS-1, and you probably will leave the other one for me, which you did. So that's great. Yeah. So this is Atlantis. It's the last mission. It's got a crew that you may have heard of the crew, because it's Doug Hurley, who is actually he was the pilot of this mission, went on to be one of the two people on the crew demo to the crewed mission of commercial crew to mm-hmm. the International Space Station. They're there right now as we record this for the SpaceX capsule. So he got to be a historic last person on the space shuttle and a historic first person to be part of commercial crew. It was a small flight. It's only four people. And that's because they needed, you know, post-Columbia, they wanted to have the ability to not only maximize what they carried to the International Space Station, but it gave them a lifeboat, essentially, with fewer people. They could abandon ship and be on the ISS if they needed to be.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the last time there were four people on a shuttle mission was in 1983. So it was quite a dramatic thing to have only the four people there. And this was, you know, other than the one Hubble servicing mission that happened at this in this late bank of the post Columbia missions, all the rest of them were International Space Station servicing and building missions. And this was as well. So it's the last one, landed back at Kennedy. And that was the end of the space shuttle era in 2011. But I have to pick it. They're mine. It's mine. My shuttle mission. Also, I went to a baseball game where Christopher Ferguson, the commander of the mission, threw out the first pitch. And
that's
that was
cool.
Super awesome because I was like, hey, it's my guy. It's my guy from my mission. So that was awesome.
That's cool. I remember this because the funding for STS-135 was real back and forth. Like for a while, it looked like maybe it wasn't going to happen. And then it made its way through Congress. And then NASA said, we're doing it. So there was real question there for a little while in, like, well, you know, 2009, 2010, if it was actually going to happen at all.
The whole idea of the post-Columbia thing was about managing the risk of them being able to, like, because they were going to do a lot more observation at the ISS of the shuttle to see if anything had fallen off, because that's basically what caused the Columbia disaster. And, you know, that's great, but you've got to have a solution for that. Like, what is the solution? And the answer was either, like, lifeboat at the ISS or another shuttle prepped and ready to go that could go up there and rescue them. But the last mission, and this is the interesting part, the last mission, you don't have any backup, right? Mm-hmm. So do you do that last mission, or does that shuttle just sit there as the backup and then get decommissioned again? And what they decided to do was fund it. So they funded it even though it's the last mission and it didn't really have a backup. But because it was going to the ISS, they figured that it was, you know, a risk worth taking, because it would only be something that would happen that would leave them in orbit, but not at the ISS. That would be a rescue kind of issue. And that didn't come to pass anyway. But yeah, it was on the edge there. But they did finally get it this last mission.
Well, you mentioned Hubble, so yep. That's where I was going to go next, to STS-61 in December of 93. This was the first of several Hubble repair missions. We've spoken about Hubble before, but basically NASA spent a whole bunch of money. They launched it, they put it into orbit, and it was out of focus. There was an issue with the main mirror, and you can't just go up and, like, bring it down. You got to be able to fix it. And so they spent a couple of years designing this instrument pack that could effectively compensate for the error in the mirror and bring everything mm-hmm. back into focus.
It's the eyeglasses for the Hubble.
Yeah, exactly. That was called COSTAR. Mm-hmm. So that instrument pack was flown aboard STS-61. The crew trained for months. They had all these instruments. They had to go up to the Hubble and grapple it and climb all over it and bring this huge components in and out of it, and end up being five EVAs. They also added new solar panels. There were also some issues with the original solar panels. It hadn't opened up fully on Hubble. But it was a huge success. And yes, there were later Hubble servicing missions, but without STS-61, some of the most iconic photography that we've ever seen, maybe in our lifetimes, wouldn't have been possible.
Yep, it's a good choice. I remember watching the servicing on CNN. That's mm-hmm. my memory of this, is I remember where I was. I was in my apartment, my second apartment I had in Berkeley, my second year of grad school, and indeed that was this mission, because that was December 1993. So I remember watching this in that apartment, and you know, again, sort of soothing, but also very, very slow to watch
mm-hmm.
space missions on TV, because it takes a long time for them to do it. But the idea that they went up there and grabbed the Hubble and installed a bunch of parts and then let it go again. And then this would not be the last. There were, you know, a handful of Hubble service missions after this. But this was the first one, and it was a big deal because it took Hubble from being kind of a joke to being able to do all the science that people wanted it to do from the beginning. All right, moving on to the fifth pick. I'm going to go with STS-95.
Okay.
From 1998. Because of one of the passengers on this mission, Payload Specialist 2, John Glenn.
Mm-hmm.
America's first man in orbit. And then many, many years later, as a retired senator, was put on a space shuttle mission. And so John Glenn, who passed away in 2016, he was the oldest, I think, oldest person ever in space.
Yes.
When he flew in 1998 at age 77. So he went from the Mercury missions and the first man to orbit the Earth, first American to orbit the Earth, to the space shuttle. And yeah, was it a little bit of a stunt? A little bit, but you know what? Come on. Like, they came up with some science for, like, what happens to old people in space and all, which was great. But just a huge, it's just what a moment in terms of the history of American human missions to space. Let's put it that way. That one of the original Mercury astronauts went back to space as a senator in his 70s.
This was on my list. I distinctly remember this. I would have been in, I guess, seventh grade, maybe. And like we talked about it in science classes. I mean, it was a big deal. And what was cool is they had a module in the pickup truck bed of the shuttle. Now, the shuttle is basically just a flying pickup truck,
right?
And called Space Hab. So they could put these modules in the payload bay and pass in and out of them, basically creating additional space.
It's like a camper, to extend your truck metaphor. This is the camper shell in the bed of the space shuttle, and it gives them the whole, you know, a large portion of the bay that might be used to deploy a satellite or whatever. Instead, it becomes human usable space.
All right, I am going to go with STS-88. This is in December of 1998. This is the first U.S. module of the International Space Station.
Yep, this was on my list.
And the space station was a years long project. You can only take up so much at a time. And you and I have been to Houston at a Johnson Space Center where they have a full size mock up of the space station in this huge warehouse, and it's massive. Right. And then you go across the street and look at a space shuttle and realize that while the payload capability of the shuttle was impressive, it's actually not that big compared to what they built with it. So lots and lots of STS missions were building out the International Space Station. So America's first module was Unity. They connected it with the first Russian module. And then they actually entered the station and equipped it. They had equipment and supplies on board Endeavour for future missions. So just a little baby space station at this point, just two little modules tied together, but the beginning of something much larger and much more impressive.
Yeah, they put Unity and Zarya together and connected the cables and all of that. And like now there's a Russian module and a U.S. module, and they're there, and it thus begins the ISS and for the rest of the shuttle's lifetime. So from this mission in 1998 through 2011 and that last mission, those 13 years were spent, 12 and a half years, were spent building the International Space Station. That was most of what the shuttle did during that period. Good pick. It was on my list.
Awesome.
See? It's always a good pick. All right, well, I'm going to go with one that might not be on your list, but I'm picking it for a couple of reasons. It's STS-41B from 1984. And I have two reasons for this. This is the Challenger. Reasons for this. Okay, one is that it's got, you've seen the picture. This is the test flight of the manned maneuvering unit. It's the first spacewalk ever done untethered, because the MMU, as it was called, is that jetpack thing. I have a refrigerator magnet of this, Steven, that I got actually when we went to Space Center Houston. I was like, oh, I got to get a souvenir to bring home. I was like, they got an MMU refrigerator magnet. So it's what we think of as like a jetpack spacesuit. It is a spacesuit with a big backpack and a bunch of maneuvering jets. And so instead of being attached to tethers and moving around that way for a spacewalk, you are zipping around. You're your own little spaceship and you're flying around. And so Bruce McCandless was the astronaut who piloted the MMU. Iconic moment, iconic photographs. That alone would probably be enough for me to put this on my list. But there's a little bit more. Because just as a trivia moment as well, and one of the things that always fascinated me is that the space shuttle, because it could land at different locations.
Mm-hmm.
So it landed originally at Edwards Air Force Base in California, and then got mated to that one of those 747s, like the one that we were in when we went to Houston, and taken back to Florida. It landed once at White Sands in New Mexico. And then what they did was they rehabbed and built the new version of the runway at Kennedy Space Center so that once they were fairly confident that everybody knew how to fly the shuttle and that they didn't need a whole dry lake bed and a giant desert, basically land anywhere you like, that they could land at a specific location, like a runway, a long runway at Kennedy Space Center, that was a lot cheaper because then you don't have to fly the space shuttle back from California. And SES-41B is the first mission to land back where it took off from at Kennedy Space Center. So that's an extra like bonus reason why SES-41B is my choice for a space shuttle draft. Yeah, there it is.
Oh, it's good. It was on my list. There's also a couple of interesting crew points here. So mm-hmm. Bruce McCandless, he was actually a Capcom during Apollo 11's EVA. He flew in the suit for 6 hours.
Yep.
And tragically, one of these crew members would be killed in the Challenger disaster.
Yeah, Ron McNair.
Just a few years later.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good one. That photo of McCandless just completely untethered, the earth below him, that is one of the iconic photos of the last century, I think.
I think so. There's a NASA prominent NASA worm logo there, too, which is fitting for on brand for the space shuttle, especially.
All right. Let me turn a little bit. I think we've done some like cool highlight stuff,
uh-huh.
But I want to pick one that is sort of a precursor to something bad. So I'm going to go with STS-51F. It's a fun name. This is a weird launch, super weird launch of Challenger in July 1985. Its first attempt on July 12th had been shut down. So the main engines on the shuttle, the main engines fired, those three motors in the back of the orbiter itself. And then several seconds later, the solid rocket boosters would ignite. And after that, you are going to space. The solid rocket boosters don't have an off button. Once they're lit, you're going somewhere. And there was a shutdown of Challenger's, the shuttle main engines, 3 seconds after ignition. This is the super unusual. The RS-25, that main shuttle engine, amazingly robust. In fact, they're using an upgraded version of this on NASA's SLS rocket that will be launching for the first time maybe next year or the year after here pretty soon. So they had this shutdown. It was a coolant valve issue. They fixed it. When they did launch, the center main engine ended up shutting down during ascent, the only in-flight failure of one of these RS-25 engines. They aborted to orbit. So on the shuttle, you had several different abort points. It's not like Apollo or something like that, where you're in a capsule at the top of the rocket and you can safely get away. The shuttle is basically next to its fuel tank.
Right.
And so that limits your options in abort. But they were able to abort to orbit. That means they ended up just being lower than planned, but still high enough to, you know, safely carry out their mission, which included a space lab modules we talked about on the John Glenn mission, where they had like a camper in the space shuttle where you could come in and out of it. They had one of those. But they also had this highly publicized experiment testing Coca-Cola and Pepsi and how you can make soda in space. But this was a hardware issue. And it feels worse in hindsight because of Challenger. We all know how that ended just 6 months after this. But definitely a notable failure in shuttle hardware.
Yeah, definitely. It sort of feels like foreshadowing, and also the abort to orbit, which is not a thing that it was discussed, but, you know, not really done.
Yeah.
The big thing that never happened in the shuttle was the abort, the transoceanic abort landing, which was, you know, you never want to see it, but it was always, they talked about it, and always kind of fascinating that, like, they had various air bases in places across the Atlantic that were ready to go in case there was an abort and they couldn't make it to orbit. So, like, you'd have to go to Zaragoza, Spain, or you'd have to go to Fairford in England. Like, they'd pick two abort sites, and then, you know, but they never had to do that. But they did have to do the abort to orbit, which still happens. That was, that's kind of what happened with the Boeing test flight of Commercial Crew, right? Where they ended up in not the orbit that they wanted because they made a mistake. And definitely they were listing in the SpaceX Commercial Crew options. They talked about all the different abort contingencies, and there are a whole bunch that are landing in the Atlantic Ocean or somewhere. And then there are the abort to orbits, where it's like, well, we can still get to orbit. It's just not an ISS orbit, and we're going to have to come back right away, but we can do that. So this was one of those for the shuttle.
Definitely right, a standout, I think.
My last pick, because we're almost at the end of the draft now, we're in round five. My last pick is STS-71. And similarly to some of my other picks here, I'm picking it for a couple of interesting sort of trivia question reasons that I find fascinating. This is the first docking of a space shuttle to a space station, but not the one you're thinking of. This is from 1995, and this is the mission where the space shuttle first docked to the Russian space station Mir, forming what was, at the time, the largest spacecraft ever to orbit the Earth, because it was Shuttle plus Mir. Also, the first time, and I'm always fascinated by this, it's the first time a shuttle crew switched members with the crew of a space station. So it's the first time the shuttle landed with a different set of people than it took off with. So that's all fascinating. And then I'm going to throw in one more, which is, they left with seven and came back with eight. So the very unusual eight people on the space shuttle. Not the, I think, only time that happened, but the first time, I believe, that the shuttle flew with eight people. So a lot of weird things going on here. So they brought up two Russians to Mir, and they took back Norm Thagard, an American who had flown up there and was at Mir with two Russians. So they did the Russian crew swap and brought back an American astronaut. So fun mission led by Hoot Gibson, another great classic NASA astronaut. And came up with seven and left with eight, and it was different people, which is pretty cool.
That is cool. That was not on my list, but that's a good choice. All right, so I've got the last pick here.
You got the last pick. You do.
All right, I am going to go with STS-100. It's a nice even number, but for a couple of reasons. One, mission specialist number one was Chris Hadfield, a very famous Canadian astronaut.
Yes.
And this mission included the first spacewalk held by a Canadian, done by Chris Hadfield. So a big milestone for our neighbors to the north. But this also marked the installation and activation of the Canada arm on the space station. Mm-hmm. So we've already mentioned a couple of times SpaceX and Boeing, these companies that end up sending capsules to the space station. Some of them can remote dock, where basically they fly up and connect to the space station automatically. But a lot of them don't have the intelligence for that, and they have to be kind of grappled out of orbit. And the Canada arm is part of that process. And it's a big deal. A future version of the Canada arm will be at the Lunar Gateway, which is a space station that's being developed to be in cislunar space, so going around the moon. That'll be a stepping stone to landing on the moon as part of the Artemis program. But the robotic arm on the space station, obviously a huge deal that it went in and went in successfully. So, STS-100, a big milestone for Canada and a big milestone for the ISS.
It's good. Did a Canadian write this part for you? Because that's a lot of Canada.
Yeah, I'm in the pocket of big Canada.
A very international crew, too, for this mission, because, you know, obviously putting together the ISS, it's got four Americans, but a Canadian, an Italian, and a Russian as a part of this ISS assembly and putting the Canada arm on there. That's mm-hmm. good. That's good. Well, I will tell you what I had left.
Okay.
Now that we're at the end of our 10, we've picked essentially the top 10 shuttle missions. I had STS-125 left on my board as my next one that I would go with, which was the last Hubble servicing mission. We've told that story as well, that at the end, that was the one where they weren't going to be able to take refuge in the ISS. And there was this fear of like, well, what happens if we need, or are we going to have another shuttle on standby and go rescue them? Is it worth the risk to people? And the NASA administrator at the time was like, meh, Hubble versus astronauts. And then all the astronauts and the public were like, no, we should do this. And they're like, all right, okay, fix the Hubble. And it was the last chance to get the Hubble working smoothly again before the shuttle was decommissioned. So I had that. And then the other ones, I had a smattering of other ones. I had STS-3 because that was the only White Sands, New Mexico landing. And I think that's just a great trivia question. Remember the time the space shuttle landed in New Mexico?
Mm-hmm.
I had STS-31, which is the deploy of Galileo, which was the probe that went to Jupiter. They actually took that up in the shuttle and then it launched from the shuttle. There's a story there too, which is post Challenger, they had to scale back the amount of propellant and the type of propellant they could have in the shuttle bay. And so Galileo had to take a lot longer to get to Jupiter because it had to like slingshot around and get, you know, to get gravitational assist, where originally it was going to go direct, but with like a liquid fueled rocket. And then after the Challenger, they're like, we're not going to do that. The idea that you'd have a rocket with a probe on it in the shuttle bay is just bananas. Like, why? What are you doing? It was the 80s. These things happened. I had a whole bunch of different Hubble service missions, but you got the best one for sure. Mm-hmm. I had STS-97, which is the first time the shuttle went to the ISS and met ISS crew that was already up there, which is kind of fun, right? It's the first time that they went to the ISS and said, hey, everybody. 102, which I almost picked, which is the first ISS crew transfer. And this is the beginning of the consistent string of crew transfers, 97 and 102 both, about how we've had somebody at the ISS all along since about 2000. And yeah, that's it. Those are my choices that I didn't get to pick. What did you have? Anything left?
Yeah. So you picked up 125. I had that as well. I also had STS-51C. It's the first shuttle mission that was classified. It was a Department of Defense payload. So we actually still aren't quite sure what they took to orbit, some sort of Department of Defense satellite. And that's important because during the design of the space shuttle, the Air Force and basically all these other government agencies said, no, we want it to do this, we want it to do that. And that influenced the design greatly, that you needed to accommodate these other customers in the U.S. government. That the shuttle wasn't just NASA's, it was kind of everybody's, which, you know, was both good and bad. So that's the first time they had flown a DoD payload. It is also notable because it's a year, almost exactly a year before Challenger. And this mission was under investigation because there were O-rings in the solid rocket boosters, which is what failed on Challenger and killed the crew. There was severe damage to them on this flight. And this flight launched in warmer weather than Challenger, but had it been as cold as Challenger, this could have been a disaster here mm-hmm. in January 85. Thankfully, it wasn't. But that problem of the O-rings being burned up showed up here and really in a major way. There have been previous issues, but this was the first real serious issue with that part, which is not good.
Yep, not great.
I'm trying to think what else I had. We had a lot of overlap. I think we did a good job with that. I think that's my one notable one that we didn't get to.
Cool. Well, that's it. We did it. We ranked the space shuttle missions from 1 to 10, basically.
Yeah, that's awesome. So if you found this interesting, if you like space stuff, we'd love for you to check out Liftoff. It's at relay.fm/liftoff. And like Jason said at the beginning of this, thank you so much for being a member, supporting our podcast and the network. It means the world to us. So I guess until next time, Jason, say goodbye.
Goodbye, members. Thank you so much.
Bye, y'all.